We are coming down the home stretch of 2024, aren't we? As we enter the 12th and final month of the Gregorian calendar. This is The Far Middle. I'm your host, Nick DeOlias. If you like what you're about to hear, and I think you will, and you want more of it, check out all prior 184 Far Middle episodes that are archived and waiting for your ears on Apple, Spotify, and Amazon platforms. And just search Far Middle, you'll find it. Or head over to nickdeolias.com for those prior episodes, along with an array of other content for your consumption pleasure. I have to admit to the constant listener base that I am embarrassed at this stage of the Far Middle's lineage with regard to the sports dedication segment at every start of an installment. Because once you publish over 180 episodes, you come to realize that as awesome as the prior sports dedication subjects were, you made some egregious omissions. True greats that somehow didn't find their way to dedication after 184 of them. We have one today. I can't explain how he hasn't been a dedication till now, and I'm sheepishly a bit embarrassed because he is, for my money, the greatest pure quarterback in the history of the NFL. And he is a Pittsburgh legend. His name's Dan Marino. He grew up in the Oakland neighborhood in the city of Pittsburgh, literally in the shadow of the Pitt campus where he would start his march to greatness. And incidentally, his childhood home was a few blocks away from my grandparents' home. His dad worked for the city newspaper that I delivered as a paperboy. Dan Marino is about as Pittsburgh as you can get. And speaking of Pitt, that was where he exploded on the national radar in sort of the late 70s, 1979 as a freshman through 1982. Get this, Marino isn't even close to being in a top 50 career NCAA passing leaders for yards. Can you believe that? But when you look at the top 50 list, there isn't a single name, and I checked it out, there isn't a single name on that top 50 that can rival what Dan Marino did in college at Pitt or across his pro career. So stats in a vacuum, they can often mislead. And Dan Marino ranks only eighth in career NFL passing yards. The names ahead of him, yeah, they include Brady and Breeze, Roethlisberger, Peyton Manning, Favre, but there's even Matt Ryan and Phil Rivers. So some great names and some of what I would refer to as accumulators over their career, like Matt Ryan and Philip Rivers, but very similar ranking when you look at career TD throws as well. So I'll tell you what, if I were starting an NFL franchise and I could pick anyone in history and in their prime for QB1, I would choose Dan Marino in his prime over any of those ahead of him on the career yards or TD list. He was the greatest pure quarterback ever, period. And without a doubt, the greatest player to never win a Super Bowl. He lost to Joe Montana, another Western Pennsylvanian, and the 49ers when Marino's Dolphins made it to the big game. And he fell to the Dolphins and Don Shula toward the bottom of the first round in that epic 1983 draft, which we talked about on a prior Far Middle dedication. And when I say he fell to the Dolphins, he went very late in the first round. The Steelers could have had him, but there were unbased rumors about his partying and drug use that were, again, unfounded. And that dropped Marino to the second to last selection in the first round. Shula was sitting there. He knew talent when he saw it, and he didn't hesitate. The rest was history. Now, five quarterbacks were drafted before Marino in that first round, five. Now, some of them are greats. You had Elway and Jim Kelly in there before Dan Marino, but you also had Todd Blackledge and Tony Eason and Ken O'Brien. Imagine that. Dan was the man through the 80s and the 90s and in college prior, as well as obviously what he did across his NFL career. There was no one like him before, and there's been no one like him since. He would absolutely dominate in the NFL today. And how many players from the past can you honestly say that about? Episode 185 goes to Dan Marino. Let's make our first connection from that Western Pennsylvania and Appalachian region legend on the gridiron to a Western Pennsylvania and Appalachian massive opportunity in the making, in the energy space. Had the opportunity a few weeks back to give a speech at the Drake Museum in Titusville, Pennsylvania, which is the birthplace of the global oil industry. And it was at an energy security forum. And in a speech, I laid out a realistic vision for where places like Pennsylvania and then the United States on a wider basis, and then frankly the world, where all of those have to head to address our collective energy needs. Now, the talk garnered a lot of attention and feedback from those in strong agreement to those who disagreed. And in the interest of civil discourse and the Far Middle Mission, I thought it would be great to summarize the key points here this week. And the full address can be found on my website, nickdeolias.com, if you wish to read it. I highlighted what I thought was a sober reality, that the energy and climate policies that you see out there today, they largely rely on a dash to wind and solar at scale. And thus, they're doomed to fail, because there's nothing renewable about wind or solar. They suffer from very low energy density, which makes it impossible to scale them without ecological damage. And the amount of wind turbines or the acreage of solar panels that you need to pursue supposed net zero plans, well, they would require blanketing entire states with either solar farms or wind farms. Offshore wind, that has all kinds of issues surrounding it with respect to whale kills along the east coast of the United States. And onshore wind, well, that's the worst thing that's happened to birds, including endangered species of birds, since the cat. Worse yet, wind and solar, you know, they're not cheap. As a foundation of an electric grid, and they stoke general inflation. It's not a coincidence that inflation is raging as economies and societies try to embark on these net zero follies, because the latter causes the former. You increase the cost of energy and you create energy scarcity. You reduce reliability of energy, and those things are going to adversely affect the cost of everything in society, because as we talked many times on the podcast, everything utilizes energy. And then there's the sort of reality that is probably the most crucial and fatal when it comes to wind and solar. They are not zero carbon or zero emitting. The supply chain life cycle assessment of what it takes to produce a kilowatt hour from solar or wind, that's going to betray huge carbon footprints. And you can sort of walk through that development chain to ascertain how big of a carbon footprint and CO2 emitting footprint it will be. So first you need to do massive mining and movement of surface area to get to the requisite materials you need to make the solar panel or the wind turbine. And that's going to require that massive mining. It's going to require substantial carbon-fueled energy and transportation and equipment. And then most of that's going to happen in foreign lands. But then once you've mined the stuff, you're going to need to concentrate it into purified feedstocks. And that's going to require even more carbon energy. And again, most of that is going to occur in foreign locations. Once it's concentrated, all those feedstocks, they're going to come together in a manufacturing facility, which is going to start building the components for wind turbines and solar panels and electric vehicle batteries in the case of EVs. And those factories, they're likely to be carbon-based power off of a grid that's carbon-based or coal-fired in many instances, if you're looking to places like China. Then all those components, they got to be transported to the United States and Europe. So whether you're looking at ships, rails, trucks, planes, doesn't matter. What's going to fuel that transportation? Yeah, it's going to be carbon-based energy. And oh, by the way, constructing the wind turbine towers and the solar arrays, that's going to require concrete. You're going to have to clear trees for pads. You're going to have to clear more trees for right-of-ways. And you're going to need metal transmission lines to move and transport the kilowatt hours. All of that is going to carry significant carbon footprints. And then once everything's installed, if the wind doesn't blow, or when it doesn't blow, or when the sun isn't shining, you're going to need a reliable backup on the grid, which is going to be some form likely of carbon-based power. You add all of that up, that quick walk that I just went through with the development, the supply chain of wind and solar, it is a very substantial carbon dioxide footprint. And same, by the way, situation you'll find for the life cycle CO2 footprint of EVs, of electric vehicles. And this reality is why it's concerning to see what elites and experts are forcing upon society, what they're imposing on economies when it comes to policy cures or medicines to tackle climate change. The consequences of those medicines or cures, they may end up being significantly worse for economies and quality of life across the globe than the actual symptoms or ailments of climate change. And none of that is going to be good news for consumers or the middle class or business, or frankly, for the environment. But that's not the end of the bad news when it comes to energy climate policies that rely heavily on wind and solar. There are dire geopolitical aspects of these policies as well, because they enable bad actors across the map. Russia is a case in point. It now enjoys all kinds of energy leverage over Europe because of predominantly EU climate policies. Europe purposely shut down domestic energy sources of natural gas and nuclear, and then you coupled it with a mad dash to wind and solar, which failed to deliver. That created an energy imbalance, and what was it filled by? By Russian natural gas through pipelines like Nord Stream. If you recall, we had an episode recently talking about the alleged sabotage of the Nord Stream pipe. Yeah, Putin saw leverage and he was emboldened to invade Ukraine because of it, not once, but twice. And China's been gifted enormous leverage from Western climate policies. It's built a stranglehold on the supply chains to manufacture an electric vehicle or a wind turbine or a solar array. The US and the EU, we simply cannot mine, process, or manufacture enough of the stuff needed for a net zero plan relying on wind, solar, and EVs. And now, because of this, China can confidently eye up Taiwan, and it's doing just that. And then how about OPEC? Yeah, the United States, with its shale revolution, it slayed OPEC. But then the climate alarmists, with their policies, they dutifully resurrected OPEC because now we need Mideast oil to flow to keep the price of oil down as we shuttered or tried to shutter our domestic oil industry, which is crazy. But it's even crazier with Iran. Iran knows that its oil is now necessary due to Western climate policies. So now we appease, loosen sanctions, and we fly pallets of cash to them, to Iran, by the way, on carbon-fueled airplanes, which is quite ironic, on a level that basically defies logic. And the debacle with Iran reaps hundreds of billions of dollars for it, which it can then use to fund Hamas and Hezbollah and pursue nuclear weapon capability. And then you've got Venezuela, totalitarian Venezuela, another disaster enabled by Western climate policies. You know, that country went from a pariah and under heavy sanction to now where we ease sanctions, we respect sham elections, we tolerate the kidnapping of our citizens by the government there, and then we ask Chevron to flow billions of dollars of Venezuelan crude to make sure it gets on the global market and keeps the price of oil down. But the biggest tragedy geopolitically are individuals in the developing world without access to reliable, affordable energy. The climate alarmist policies, they ensure that those people continue to be denied reliable and affordable energy. It makes you wonder, what gives anyone the moral authority to do so? So what's really behind these policies? Because they obviously make no sense when you look at it from the perspectives of chemistry, physics, math, and economics. I think I know what's behind it, and it's an adversary lurking externally and internally. The natural enemy of Western Republican democracy is the left. It can be communist or socialist or totalitarian or some combination of those three. And the left benefits from climate policies on an unprecedented scale because these policies force a transition from energy independence of the West to an energy dependency of the West on totalitarian nations of the left. And since the left despises the individual and his or her freedom to choose for themselves, it looks to tear away that freedom and then place that decision-making power in the hands of a higher authority, a religion or ideology, the state, the expert class, or often a toxic cocktail of all three of those. And what better way to achieve the aims of the left than by controlling energy through climate policy? Yeah, if you wanted to control society and the individual, but you could only choose one industry or sector to achieve it by, which one would you choose? Which would you pick? Healthcare, some might say, or some might pick finance, tech industry. And those aren't bad choices. Those are very impactful industries. But I wouldn't choose any of those. If I would choose one, it would be energy. Because the kilowatt hour, the horsepower, and the BTU, they touch everything in a modern economy. And thus, you're able to control decision making. So climate policies may not be about atmospheric carbon dioxide levels, and I don't think it's about the weather. I think it's about control. And if my premise is correct, one would see climate policies bleeding into things beyond the generation grid. And we're seeing just that, aren't we? Look at food. What you can and what you should eat, it's being attacked and critiqued by everyone from radical environmentalists to the United Nations. Now experts demand that we consider the carbon footprints of foods. And there is a hit list. Red meat, ice cream, beer, they're on that hit list. So if you like those foods, got some bad news. that might be coming your way when these climate policies continue on that inevitable march that they've got toward control of the individual. Driving, that's another front in the fight. What better expression of personal freedom than the personal automobile? But when you look at EV mandates, the individual now is reliant on the availability of the grid and when and where you may charge. Climate policies aim to transition the personal car from a quality of life booster for the masses to a luxury of the 1%. It's another form of control. And then we've talked in the past on this podcast about the concept of 15-minute cities. That's that movement found in climate policies to ultimately force individuals to live in urban areas within so many minutes of walking distance to public transportation, because public transportation would be the only mode of transportation available, and to force living in basically small apartments versus larger individual homes, another form of control. And then climate policy, you're starting to manifest it in emergency powers, climate emergency days that you now see in California. So when it's hot, don't charge your EV, don't run your air conditioner, frankly, don't open your business. It's a grid emergency, ironically created by climate policies. The individual loses control over their own decision-making. That's the net effect of all the culmination of these tactics. And instead of your own decision-making, you're going to have to trust in the higher authority, the government or the expert, in line, of course, with the ideology of the left. They'll take care of you. They'll tell you what to do. But you know, history informs what happens once the left controls. Now, all that, you know, might be depressing, but the good news is there is a quite exciting path if you assess things clinically, especially for Appalachia. And I admit I've got a somewhat contrarian view versus the common consensus that you often hear out there in the energy space. So let me share my thoughts, see what you think. First, I do agree with certain aspects of the common consensus. I do agree that, for example, policy in key sectors of the global economy, they're going to continue to pursue lower CO2 emissions. It may not be zero, right? But it's going to be much, much lower than current. I do believe that policy is mandating, for better or for worse, an electrification of everything. And that's going to result in unprecedented demand growth for the power grid. And the most recent example out there are data centers and AI. And I agree that the ability of wind and solar to deliver uninterruptible, reliable, and low-cost energy at scale to feed that growing grid demand, it's extremely suspect. I could say much worse and be much more direct about it, so I'm sort of being kind by just calling it extremely suspect. Now, with all that in mind, natural gas should be the clear winner across energy sources to meet higher energy demand at lower CO2 intensity. And then better yet, when you're looking at Appalachia, this basin, and places like Pennsylvania, with the Marcellus and Utica shales, it's the premier natural gas deposit on the planet. So if all this comprised the complete analysis and game board, a logical person would rightly conclude that the Appalachian basin's poised to flourish, and one would have expected these results to have already manifested in current market metrics. We should have already seen this happening. Yet that has not occurred. And I don't think it's going to occur without a shift in the situational assessment by the energy industry and capital markets and policymakers. I think we are all misreading things. And this is where I begin to diverge from the common consensus. What do I think? Well, I believe a couple things. I believe the policy across governments and bureaucracies prohibits the smooth allocation of capital into infrastructure like natural gas pipelines that would link Appalachian natural gas to growing grid demand. And attempts to navigate this, when you try to do that, and you try to get through these policy roadblocks, you're going to be met with a coordinated lawfare campaign that's going to strangle you with litigation. So the idea of a new natural gas pipeline to provide Appalachian energy to, say, Boston, that is like very obvious that there's a need for that, and it's logical. But such a pipeline is not going to be allowed to be built because it's counter to that ideology that permeates a system from which approval for the natural gas pipeline must be secured to proceed. I also think that the energy industry, it then looks to LNG, liquefied natural gas export, as being the answer, the salvation. But to unlock the next wave of Appalachian supply, LNG is going to require more natural gas pipelines to move our product to coastal LNG terminals for export. And even setting aside the infrastructure constraints of pipelines, a true step change in LNG export capacity It's likely a non-starter over the next decade because of policy and legal constraints on LNG export facilities, the most recent example being the LNG permit pause. And then I also think that then there are others in the industry, when they flip from LNG export as being the answer, they now point to that growing grid demand that we just talked about to power AI and data centers. That's the new answer. That's the new salvation. And after all, the advantage of that one is that such demand in basin, it's not going to require those new long-haul natural gas pipelines or those large-scale LNG export facilities. That's good news. But here's the problem. The tech industry, who buys the power to feed those data centers and that AI economy, it's demanding the power come from something that offers a low or net zero CO2 footprint. So the customer, the tech industry, doesn't want just low cost and reliable power. They want low cost, reliable, and low net zero CO2 power. So those realities, or those three beliefs that I've got, that might depress at first blush. But again, there is an exciting path available from the herd mentality. Now, what would that look like? Well, it's been something that I've been pondering for some time. You see, there are key sectors of today's economy that are growing, and they've got a massive appetite for energy. You've got the hydrogen economy that you find within the Inflation Reduction Act. You've got sustainable aviation fuel for the aviation industry. We talked about data centers and AI on the power grid. And then you've got all of these transportation fleets. Energy to those sectors, they've got to check certain boxes to work. They've got to be reliable. They've got to be uninterruptible. They've got to be low cost. You want a short supply chain. You want it ready now, not in a decade. And you want it to be net zero or low CO2. And you want the ability to demonstrate that there's no harm to local or regional ecosystems where the energy is coming from. Now, none of the touted energy solutions that you hear about out there today, none of them check all the boxes. Wind and solar, we covered that. Those are fatal with regard to their shortcomings. Nuclear, a lot of excitement with nuclear, but recent experience is not promising when it comes to its cost. It's ultra high cost to build, as evidenced recently by Georgia Power, who brought on a new plant recently. And it's not a ready now solution. It would take years to build out its scale. Natural gas, hey, many advantages. A lot of those boxes are checked. But there is one key shortcoming. It's not net zero CO2. So which energy solution would check all the boxes? I think Appalachia offers a few. The first is captured coal mine methane, or CMM. The U.S. Department of Energy found that coal mine methane, CMM, is a carbon negative product and that it reduces the methane emissions entering the atmosphere. So when CMM is captured and custom blended with the, say, Marcellus and Utica shales, companies like the one I work for can deliver to customers that we've just mentioned and those industries that we just mentioned an energy supply with the exact carbon intensity desired. You can dial it in and tailor blend it. And a coal mine methane blended product has a fraction of the cost of something like new nuclear. And by the way, it offers scalability and reliability and supply chain benefits that are far superior to obviously wind and solar. But the solutions from Appalachia, they are not just limited to coal mine methane. You've got technologies that are now ready for deployment, many of them developed within the company that I work for, CNX Resources, which is doubly exciting, that will allow us to harness unique characteristics of the deep Utica shale horizon to then manufacture low cost, low carbon intensity CNG and LNG on pad. So you're manufacturing liquefied natural gas or compressed natural gas at the wellhead. And that will be able to serve growing sectors of energy demand that we just ran through. So just think about those sectors again. You got hydrogen production with the hydrogen economy. Well, doing that at scale requires enormous amounts of reliable energy. You take something like coal mine methane blended with shale gas, that is a ready now solution to provide net zero hydrogen at scale. And when you couple that with the provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act, that can kickstart, and it should frankly kickstart, hydrogen production across Appalachia. We talked about sustainable aviation fuel with the aviation industry. You know, the creation of SAF, or sustainable aviation fuel, to decarbonize aviation, boy, it's remained elusive. And emerging alternatives to existing jet fuels, frankly, they failed to meet scalability and cost challenges. But CMM blended with that shale gas, That provides a net zero CO2 solution. And we've got actually the company I work for at CNX, we've got a project ongoing with our partners at the Pittsburgh International Airport, which will be the first sustainable aviation fuel plant at scale that's utilizing coal mine methane. And then the reshoring of American industry. You hear about that all the time from politicians these days and policymakers. Reshoring that industry, that is another opportunity for Appalachia and its energy space, because manufacturers, they're looking to decarbonize and they want to de-risk their supply chains. Well, they're going to look to places like Appalachia as a prime location to do just that. And then AI, yep, AI will increase energy demand. And again, Appalachia is uniquely positioned to benefit from this growth because of its proximity to coal mine methane, its short supply chains to shale gas from the Marcellus and Deep Utica, and all this legacy infrastructure and existing pipeline infrastructure that are already in place. But again, the AI economy and that tech industry, they need energy solutions at scale today, not in a decade. So data center developers, they're going to be logical customers for coal mine methane blends and things like on-pad manufacturing of CNG and LNG. And then speaking of pad-level CNG, LNG, those things are poised to disrupt those transportation fleets that I mentioned earlier by basically displacing diesel and gasoline, the current fuel, those fleets. And those solutions with pad-level CNG, LNG, they're reliable, they're local, they're ready now to drop emissions and improve economics by dropping costs by converting away from those heavier hydrocarbons. Yeah, the opportunity for the Appalachian Basin and for places like Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Eastern Ohio, Virginia, and its Western Panhandle are very exciting. And end markets are just starting to realize it. We are about to experience a transformation of Appalachia, constant listeners, and that is a massive opportunity. Well, it's time to wrap up this episode, but we're going to do it by making a connection from what we just covered, a massive potential opportunity in Appalachia in the future, to remembering a nearly massively tragic event that inspired the lyrics of a famous rock song. And the event occurred on our air date of December 4th, but back in 1971. So first, let's talk about the nearly tragic, massively tragic event. There was a Swiss casino known as the Casino de Montreux, and that was on the Lake Geneva shoreline. See if you know where I'm going with this. Some of you rock fans might have already picked it up with when I said it was on the Lake Geneva shoreline. Its auditorium at the casino, it had a circular recessed ceiling above the stage that was made from wood and included curtains and papier-mâché decorations that were hung, I guess, in preparation for the upcoming Christmas holiday. And this location was where the Montreux Jazz Festival was started in 1967. And the festival was held at this casino during the summer. So the casino's auditorium hosted rock and other concerts throughout the year when the jazz show wasn't playing in the summer. Now, in 1971, the casino hosted a concert by Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. And Frank Zappa said, this is a quote from him, there were between 2,500 and 3,000 kids packed into the room, well over capacity. And there were no chairs in the open auditorium. And back then, it wasn't yet common to stand during concerts on the floor. So basically, the audience was sitting on the floor. And the concert was in mid-afternoon, wasn't in the evening or at night. Now, during the set from Frank Zappa, a fire started. Someone allegedly shot off a flare that soared into the rafters, that ceiling. And the heat from the flare ignited a fire. It quickly grew out of control, and many thought it was part of Zappa's stage and light show early on. They didn't even know it was an actual fire. But after becoming aware of the fire, Frank Zappa tells the audience, this is what he said, fire, if you'd kindly move calmly toward the exit, ladies and gentlemen, calmly. So Frank Zappa kept a cool head, and there was very little panic getting out, although one of the door exits was locked and had to be smashed down, and some attendees had to basically jump out of a broken window 10 feet or so to the ground. But thankfully, there were no fatalities and only a few injuries. And it led this fire, which ended up consuming the entire casino, it was a massive fire, it led to the lyrics of one of the most famous songs in rock history. And this is the rest of the story, so to speak. You see, the hard rock group Deep Purple, and I am a massive Deep Purple fan, band members of Deep Purple were in Montreux and were planning to start recording what would become one of their best albums, Machine Head. And they wanted to record it at the Montreux Casino the next day after the Zappa concert. And some of the members of Deep Purple were at the Zappa show when the fire actually occurred. Well, the fire, it gutted the casino, and Deep Purple was left without a place to record the album. And the Smoke on the Water, that became the title of the song on that album, referred to the smoke from the fire spreading over Lake Geneva from the burning casino as the members of Deep Purple watched from their hotel. Now, here are the opening lines to Smoke on the Water, which is the signature song from Deep Purple and off of their album Machine Head. We all came out to Montreux on the Lake Geneva shoreline to make records with a mobile. We didn't have much time now. Frank Zappa and the Mothers were at the best place around, but some stupid with a flare gun burned the place to the ground. And that's how the lyrics and the title of one of the most famous songs in rock history came to be. So from Dan Marino to Appalachia's bright energy future to Deep Purple, it's been a great episode. Until next week, always stay connected to that far middle.